Welcome back to Libromania, a new podcast for the book obsessed from the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern. If you love books and all the things that make books great, this podcast is for you. Each week, I'll be presenting conversations with authors, designers, publishers, artists, biographers, critics, and scholars about the various things that make books worth celebrating. We will be talking about book design and bookstores, book printing and book collecting. We'll be talking about the lives and problems of famous authors and the science behind our love of books. We'll be talking with working writers about their process and with scholars about the art of writing biography. This is Chapter 3, in which I investigate the popularity of one of the 20th century's most popular and beloved novels. Back in October, PBS ran an 8-episode TV series called The Great American Read, in which it sought to discover what America's favorite novel really is. Nearly 4.3 million votes were cast, choosing from 100 finalists that included titles as varied as the Harry Potter series and the Chronicles of Narnia, Pride and Prejudice and Jane Eyre, Gone with the Wind and The Lord of the Rings, and yes, even Twilight, 50 Shades of Grey, and the works of James Patterson. As USA Today wrote, in the end, the winner, the book deemed America's most popular novel was, bum bum bum, To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee's coming-of-age novel from 1960. It's no surprise, really. I shouldn't think any of you would be very surprised about that. In fact, when I saw who the winner was, I said to myself, out loud, I think, well, duh. But then I got to thinking about why it's so popular, so beloved, why it's endured so well and even so long compared to many of the other books of the last century. And I figured, what's the point of having a podcast like this that explores what makes great books great if you're not going to answer questions like that? So in today's episode, I'll be contemplating that question. Why is To Kill a Mockingbird so popular? Not just why is it well-liked or why do people still read it in schools, but why is it quite as popular as it has become? To help me, I spoke with two experts on the subject. First, I spoke with Mr. Adam Andrews, who is the director of the Center for Lit and the author of Teaching the Classics, and he's also the host of the popular podcast Bibliophiles. Adam's a good friend of mine and one of my favorite bookish hangs, so I figured this was an obvious topic. We chatted about the literary merit of the book, focusing in particular on why it's so popular for schools and why so many people read it at such a young age. Then I chatted with Dr. Joseph Crispino, history professor at Emory University and the author of the new book Atticus Finch, The Biography, Harper Lee, Her Father, and the Making of an American Icon. Dr. Crispino and I focused on the character of Atticus Finch and the place of the book in the culture at large. I'm grateful to both of these gentlemen for joining me. I think you'll enjoy their insights quite a bit. So let's get right to it. First up, here's my conversation with Adam Andrews as we try to get to the bottom of the popularity of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, first of all, thank you for being here, Adam. As always, it is a pleasure to talk books with you.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
So you run a thing called Center for Lit. The Center for Lit? Center for Lit, right?
Center for Lit, right.
So given that you run a thing called Center for Lit, it seemed like you were an appropriate person to talk to about literature. So figured I'd get my friend Adam Andrews on the line and we could talk about just that.
Well, I appreciate the invite.
Are you a huge To Kill a Mockingbird fan?
Well, I do have a picture of the a poster of one of the covers from the 60s on the wall of my office. So I guess you'd probably have to say yes.
Yeah, but have you actually read the book?
I have read the book a time or two, yes.
So it's not just the cover art. You're not just,
it's not just the cover art.
You're not into like 1960s cover art collecting it.
Well, I am, but there's other reasons for my interest in Mockingbird.
Yeah, and that particular cover art, yeah. So when was the first time you read it?
I read it as probably a sixth grader.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Can't really remember the circumstances under which I read it. I think I might've just, found it in my mom and dad's house had one of them tell me that's a classic and read it that way. I was too young, I remember, to really get the, to put it bluntly, I didn't really understand what the trial was all about.
Yeah. Yeah.
I certainly didn't understand what the unspoken ramifications of the trial at the climax of that novel were all about. So you might say that part of the weight of the novel was lost on me, but it had a pretty profound effect, nevertheless, in some other ways.
Yeah. Do you think that's the right age for that? Or would you say that it probably, if you were, well, wait, when did you give it to your kids? You have multiple kids.
Our kids, theoretically, the Andrews family is the homeschooling family, and we have six kids, and so we generally give it to them as seniors in high school.
Okay, but you read it as a sixth grader, you said. So, would you think the sixth grader is too young?
Just absolutely.
You'd say too young. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, and the reason I say that is that in order to really understand what Harper Lee is going for literarily, you need to be able to follow along with the subject matter that she's constructed. And it's in my view, a little mature for the for the sixth grader on average.
So Flannery O'Connor famously called it she said, I wonder if all those people who are buying up that book realize they're buying a children's book or something like that. Some classic Flannery O'Connor snark, you know, and it was in a letter, I think. So who knows what she actually, you know, she's probably just picking a little bit of fun. But do you, what do you think of that contention by O'Connor that this is essentially a children's book, given that you would say, read it as an older?
I don't know. Kid. I have no idea what O'Connor would have meant by that. So it's hard to comment, but I certainly think Harper Lee was after a different game than O'Connor. That I think that would probably be fair. But in terms of in terms of it being, in my view, for slightly older readers, that's a statement about the subject matter and the content and the emotional maturity level, I think, that's necessary to be able to hold those things and to see them as dramatic and literary elements.
Yeah.
And to understand that you're reading a work of art and it's dealing with certain content, and to be able to be to have a step of separation. Need to be a little bit older in order to do that effectively, I would say.
So when it comes to so basically, it seems to be taught in most schools, many schools anyway, including public schools, in that ninth, 10th grade range. Seems to be the most common area from what I can tell, and doing a very cursory overview of some research on the question. And it's often one of the first books that students read from the perspective of they're going to write a sort of essay about the book, and they're going to identify all these very specific literary elements, and then they're going to produce some kind of an essay. I was reading an article in which the writer said something like, this is probably the first book where you had to write an essay, and you probably answered one of these four prompts, and then just list four most common prompts. And it's probably true that, you know, most, there's like just sort of the canon of To Kill a Mockingbird prompts. But
right,
why do you think that it's a book that sort of way of reading it has become so popular, that let's give it to a ninth or a 10th grader, you know, in schools all across the country, let's use it as one of the first books that kids are learning to write, you know, literary analysis about? What is it about it that makes it popular for that?
It's a great question. And I think that the answer, in my view, the answer is because its subject matter and its theme and the purpose of its author is perfectly consonant with the plan and program of modern American public education, which is to inculcate sanctioned opinions about politics, about race relations, pure and simple. It's a beautiful literary masterpiece level treatment of mainstream sanctioned political, social, and racial opinions. And so it's the perfect tool for an American high school lit class.
I can't tell if you mean that as a compliment or an insult.
That's just a statement of fact. I think that's the reason that in my view, that's the reason that To Kill a Mockingbird is the most popular, well-known, beloved American classic, because it was written in 1960 at the height of the civil rights unrest about that topic.
Yeah.
And it set that topic in a glorious treatment and made it universal and made it not just a story about Scout and Jim, not just a story about the race relations in a small Southern town, and not just a coming of age story about two kids, but a coming of age story about a whole country and a whole nation, delivered right at the moment when that coming of age process was coming to a head.
It's like a national buildings roman.
Exactly right. I would say that absolutely. It's a buildings roman for the nation. Mm. And educators in the years since 1960 look back and say, what is the number one thing as an educational establishment that we're trying to do in creating American citizens? What's the number one idea that we want them to come out of our system with in their hearts? And Harper Lee basically is giving them that very idea. And as I said before, she's doing it in such a beautiful way, literarily, that they can kill two birds with one stone, give them exposure to great literature and turn out the right kind of political and social thinkers.
Yeah, there's lots of books out there that attempt to produce a certain kind of person or a certain kind of thinker, or at least a certain kind of thought, but they don't all do it with the sort of precision and beauty that Harper Lee manages to do.
I think you're right. And I think this may throw shed some light on the comment you just delivered me, this supposedly from Flannery O'Connor. In that sense, it is very, it's very plain. It's very broad. It's not subtle. It doesn't proceed by obfuscation. It's not ironic. There's nothing hard to get about the message of To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah. And
it's,
I guess,
there's sincerity about it that is unusual.
It's very clear. And it's also, you can almost hear Harper Lee doing the same thing that American educators have done with the book ever since. See, children, this is how we should think. This is how we should behave. And maybe that's what O'Connor in that comment is, maybe that's what she meant. Hmm.
So, nevertheless, despite all this stuff, which I, again, it may be considered a compliment or an insult, you have a great affection for this book. It seems like you,
oh my goodness. Yes.
It's have the poster.
It's a wonderful story.
So from a, I guess the question then is, why do you love it so much? What, as a literary, I don't want to insult you by calling you a scholar, but but
thank you very much.
But as a literature teacher, as someone who loves literature and loves discussing it and spends your day in the midst of it and surrounded by it, and by the posters that it produces, what is it about that has led you to have that much affection for it? I mean, this is certainly I'm asking you a very subjective question, but I think that hopefully we'll get at some more.
Yeah. Oh, I could go on and on and on. I mean, at Center for Lit, which is the literature curriculum books and reading organization that I work with, one of the main things we're always trying to do with readers is help them to understand literature by looking at its structural elements, looking at setting as an element of literature, and see how authors use setting and construct setting in order to emphasize their themes. Then doing the same thing with conflict and with plot and with characterization. One of the great things about Mockingbird is in all of these areas, it is particularly skillful and particularly evocative. And if you take any one of those components separately and just glory in the way, for example, that Harper Lee creates a setting, and you come away with just a deep experience of literary art at its best. Her opening chapter, when she describes the heat in the summer in the South of the 1930s, puts you in the world in a way that you just rarely do you have that experience. I mean, I can think of Hawthorne doing it in The Scarlet Letter and Twain doing it in Huckleberry Finn, but she's up there with Hawthorne and Twain in terms of her ability to create a setting. That line where she says, the sweat and sweet talcum, you know, became like frosting on the skin of the ladies, and they had to have two showers a day, and you know, it was hotter then. And, you know, the setting is just
my favorite. One of my favorite lines. It was hotter then.
Yeah. And so if you take any of the other structural elements of fiction, she's just as good. The characterization of Jem and Scout and the way she chooses a narrative voice to do it in the first person through Scout's eyes, but the wonderful juxtaposition of Scout the child as the character in the story and Scout the articulate, subtle, sensitive grown-up who's actually giving us her childish recollections. The combination of those two perspectives is stirring and powerful and allows us, for example, to see Atticus through two sets of eyes at once. As the object of her childlike hero worship, and then as also the object of a more mature hero worship. She loved him as a child and looked up to him. She respects him as an adult in the retelling, and it burnishes his character and stature from two directions. Elements of characterization like that are just, they put her in very, very elite company. Mm. I could go on and on about the other structural elements of the story, but they all work together. I mean, she's a five-star talent in all areas. And so the book is thoroughly strong in every way.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Atticus Finch himself. He's one of the reasons why this book was named as the great American, well, not the great American novel per se, but the most popular of all American novels. But you can't have a novel be in the running for a great American novel, as most critics consider this to be, without having a really excellent cast of characters. And Scout and Jem are obviously the characters through which, you know, we see the world. They're kind of proxy for us as the audience. but there's like the moral fabric of the story, and in some ways the weight of the story is centered around Atticus Finch. And first of all, would you agree with that?
Well, I think that he's certainly the, I would call Atticus the most important secondary character in Mockingbird. And the reason I say he's a secondary character is that he doesn't have protagonist status in my reading, because his character isn't confronted with the kind of soul changing, character molding conflicts. He doesn't go through an existential change of perspective. He's more a catalyst that against which the other characters bounce, and in connection with the other characters receive their change. So So I think he's the most important of the other characters in the story. And I think that Scout and Jem and Macomb, Alabama as a town are more the protagonists of the story. But yeah, he's definitely without Atticus, no Mockingbird for sure.
Why do you think that he has sort of lingered in the consciousness of American readers? Well, readers really worldwide, as such a crucial, beloved, meaningful character. Because on the one hand, there is this sort of moral depth to him, sort of ethical depth to him. And then that's somewhat complicated, of course, in the recent sequel that came out. But what about him as a character? You talk about how she manages to draw these really richly created characters. Really, they feel like real people. In what ways does that manifest itself through Atticus Finch? And is that why? Is that why people love him so much?
Well, I think that might be two questions. I wonder if people love him so much because, and this also probably explains the fairly negative reaction to the sequel that was recently published. People love him so much because he is, he's perfect. They love him because he doesn't have any, he's not a multifaceted character. He does have a history. Mm-hmm. A context, a personal context that we can put this particular struggle with the trial of Tom Robinson into, but he's never wavered in all his history from his morally pure, doggedly determined, selfless, self-sacrificial stance toward the world. He is instantly ready at any point because of his principles to lay down his life. And we love this. There's nothing to criticize about Atticus, which makes him a beloved character on the one hand, and then something of a, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but something of a flat character on the other. The Atticus of Mockingbird would never do anything untoward ever. And for this reason, he's an easy example. He's an easy exemplar to give to children. And so the sequel, where the prequel, I guess you would call it, where Lee begins her creation of Atticus by making him much more multifaceted, it just drove people nuts, I think, when it first came out.
Do you think that, is what you're saying a criticism of the book?
Oh, of Mockingbird?
Yeah.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Because every great work of literature needs a combination of the characters that the story's really about, that you're following, the ones that are coming of age and seeing the world through new eyes and becoming adults. And in the case of Mockingbird, having their innocence torn away. You need to have those characters that you're watching, and they've got to be able to interact with a cast of background characters that give their journey context and meaning. And Atticus is chief among these. Scout and Jem are learning that the world they assumed existed in the halcyon summer days of playing around with Dill and trying to get Boo Radley to come out isn't actually as idyllic as they expected it to be. And it's Atticus who impels them to that realization by dragging them into the world of the trial, and also helps them be all right through the transition. He was there when I looked in on him. He would be there when Jem waked up in the morning. That's Atticus's role. He's our context for the change that we all must go through as we come of age. So it's not a criticism at all, but it's necessary in the literary structure of the piece that he not be changeable, that he be a little bit more, I mean, flat is a derogatory word. I don't mean it badly, but that he be static and foundational in the sense of not changing.
Well, okay, a couple more questions for you. quickly. I know we don't have all day to do this as much as I would love to do that. Do you have a passage in particular that you love from this book that, I don't know if you have your book handy, but that you might be able to either describe for us or read to us?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Do you need me to talk while you find it?
Well, it's yeah, talk for just a second, or maybe we could just cut a section out where I...
Well, no, what, you don't think this is good radio? It's good podcast content?
I guess you can't see that my head is actually down in my copy of...
people quietly looking for text for pages to read. But I have a copy of there's a Life magazine special edition on, you know, called The Enduring Power of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's got all kinds of stuff about the book and the movie and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
And on the cover is an image of Gregory Peck reading To Kill a Mockingbird. So you and Gregory Peck have something in common right now.
I found it. I love it. Yeah, my favorite passage in the story, I'm probably not alone in this. This is probably, this puts me in a gigantic group of lovers of the story, is in the last chapter when Scout walks Boo Radley home and lets go of his hand. She says, "He gently released my hand, opened the door, went inside and shut the door behind him. I never saw him again." And then she has a little vision standing there on the Radley porch. It says she, "I turned to go home. Streetlights winked down the street all the way to town. I had never seen our neighborhood from this angle." And she describes her view of her very familiar neighborhood from a new vantage point. And then in this moment of seeing the world from a new perspective, she has a vision. And it's a vision, kind of like the visions in a Flannery O'Connor story, where it's a kind of a divine, it's not a divine one in Harper Lee's lingo and her vocabulary, but she has a vision of a world where we all see things from different perspectives, and we have the ability to, as she says here in this paragraph, she says, "Atticus was right. One time he said, you never really know a man until you stand in his shoes and walk around in them. Just standing on the Radley porch was enough." I think that's a great passage because it summarizes really the game that Harper Lee is shooting at in all of these interlocking stories about mockingbirds being killed unnecessarily and about children and towns and nations coming of age to realize who they really are and what kind of world they live in. The game she's shooting at is, if you walk around in somebody else's shoes, then you can really understand them. And I love the way that she puts it in such a nice image there at the end of her story.
Yeah. And I like that that concept you were talking about just now of coming of age and understanding who you really are. That's both, you've got to understand what's good about yourself and what's bad about yourself, right?
Yeah.
Know what it is that I need to sort of reinforce and pursue. But also what do I need to turn away from?
And yeah, I think that's really true.
In that image that she's creating, that both those things are in play as well.
Yeah, they really are. And I think Atticus, in his way, represents the better, our better natures, right? Mm-hmm. And Bob Ewell represents our baser natures. And I think you're right that both of those things are in play. And those two characters, equally flat, by the way, equally static, represent the two poles of what's in all of us, not just individually, but communally as a nation. And the key to navigating between those extremes in some sort of reality is quote unquote standing on the Radley porch.
Okay, my final question. What do you think of the sequel? What's your opinion of it? You say you'd mentioned that people were getting bent out of shape about the portrayal, the kind of adjusted portrayal, if you will, of Atticus Finch. But what's your take on it?
Well, we could talk a long time about that one. It's fascinating to me that was released when it was, that it was written when it was, and to see the two novels flipped in order, in their kind of historical order, and to see how the second one, To Kill a Mockingbird, kind of emerged from what I can only imagine were editorial comments on the first one, was just a fascinating thought experiment to me. But literally and thematically, thought it was really interesting, the ambiguity that was much more a part of that Go Set a Watchman. in some ways more interesting, because I think ambiguity is where the great artistic interest lies. There weren't as many cut and dried characters. Not even Scout was as cut and dried in Watchmen as she was in Mockingbird. And I can see why Mockingbird was the runaway success, and why that's the one they went to, you know, they went to press with instead.
Yeah.
And it perfectly explains, in my view, how it became so popular. But the other one is very interesting as well. And I think contemplation of the development of personal characters in Gossetta Watchmen, is really, really fruitful. Mm. They're closer to reality, I think, in that one than they are in Mockingbird.
Mm. Mm. But maybe
because there's something about Atticus. I mean, we've talked about Atticus already, but there's something about him that we love, but he's also, we have a hard time imagining him walking in the room. You know, he's a character from literature. He's an archetype.
Yeah.
And you know, the Atticus of Watchmen, I think, is more a real person.
I think that when you said that, I immediately thought of Gregory Peck walking in the room, which then made me realize that maybe one of the great accomplishments of the movie, I mean, it's a great movie in many ways. It's well written. The adaptation is really well done. The acting is really well done. But Gregory Peck managed to sort of take this archetype, as you called him, and give him flesh and blood in a way that seemed to, he was able to kind of make him into a real character in a way.
Oh,
that,
yeah, I agree.
If he wasn't that way, the movie wouldn't work. And movies and books, movies and novels obviously work on different planes in our imaginations. But Gregory Peck, and that has to have enhanced the sort of, the legend, I guess, of Atticus Finch and of,
I would definitely agree with that.
And of this book. And of course, the movie came out relatively quickly after the book was published. It's not like they waited 40 years and then did it. So they came into the sort of American consciousness at the same time. How many people read the book, wrote the essays, and then watched the movie in their ninth grade literature class since 1967 or whenever it was?
They watched the movie instead of reading the book.
And right. Wrote the I figured I'd give people the benefit of the doubt, which maybe they may have been foolish. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining me on the show. This is great fun. I may have to call you about some other books as they come up, but To Kill a Mockingbird's a great one. I will let you get back to staring at that poster on the wall for the rest of your afternoon.
Hey, thanks, David. Good to be here.
Anything you want to plug? What's going on with the Center for Lit?
Center for Lit has got a million and one things going on. Our website, centerforlit.com, is filled with resources for readers and teachers and students. In particular, though, we've got a podcast that's related to all things literary called Bibliophiles. And the Center for Lit crew gets together. There are four or five of us, depending on the episode, hash out everything we can think of in terms of ideas related to the great books and the great conversation. Mm. So we invite you to join us. Bibliophiles. It's on iTunes and Stitcher, and you can find it on our website, centerforlit.com.
Awesome. Awesome. I love the show. I hope people will subscribe and leave reviews and leave stars and all the things that help podcasts out. It's a great podcast, everyone. So go check that out. Adam, again, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Well, thanks so much to Adam Andrews for joining me to talk about the literary merits and the literary place of To Kill a Mockingbird. To learn more about Adam's work, you can head over to centerforlit.com or make sure you search Bibliophiles wherever you get your podcasts and listen now. It's a really great podcast if you love literature, particularly the teaching of literature. Of course, like I mentioned, there's more to Kill a Mockingbird than just the literary merit of it. It still has this place in the culture, and in particular, there is this character of Atticus Finch who is so beloved. Adam and I referenced that a little bit in our conversation there. And that's where I wanted to talk to Dr. Joseph Crispino. He is the department chair of history at Emory University. And as I said, he's the author of Atticus Finch, the biography, Harper Lee, Her Father, and the Making of an American Icon. That book came out in 2018, so I hope you'll find a copy of that wherever you get your books. So here he is. Here's Dr. Joseph Crispino talking about the character of Atticus Finch and the place of the book in the culture at large.
Well, let me begin by saying thank you for joining me again. It's always so much fun to talk to people who love books about books that I love. And when John Wilson recommended you, he's one of the first people I go to ask, who should I talk to about this? And he recommended you within, I think, like 5 minutes of me sending him a direct message on Twitter. So that told me everything I needed to know, I suppose. How long have you been teaching about Harper Lee and about To Kill a Mockingbird?
Well, I haven't taught about the book for very long. I've had a course I offered a couple of times, a seminar kind of on Atticus Finch in American history. But I've been interested in the novel and in the character of Atticus for a very long time. Mm. I wrote a piece back when I was in graduate school that was published in a journal, Southern Cultures, in 2000. And that was, you know, and for, but it's been very hard to write about the book, because we had such limited sources to think about it. We had just the novel itself, the one novel that Harper Lee wrote. And we had, the things that have been picked over that she'd said about it, you know, in the early 1960s when she spoke on the record. Of course, the last time she spoke on the record to a reporter about her fiction was in March of 1964. So there was just very little to go on in terms of thinking about the novel or thinking about the history of it and its reception. So I wrote about that back in 2000, but then all of that changed in the summer of 2015 with the publication of Ghosts at a Watchman. Right. And that's what really led me to come back to Kill a Mockingbird and to the character, and opened up a whole new set of avenues that you could explore this work. Hmm.
Well, I want to come back to Ghost at a Watchman at some point. I'm curious to hear your opinion of it. It seems like the response was somewhat divided, I suppose. But you talked about you were interested in the character of Atticus Finch, and I believe he was named by certain polls, I don't know if other reader polls or critic polls, but as the greatest hero in American literature. And that got me thinking a little bit about why people love him and why people love this book. What is it about both his character and the book itself that resonates so much with people, to the extent that it would be even named the most popular or the greatest novel of all time, even among readers in the UK, which I found interesting. And I was wondering if some of that has to do with just a nostalgia factor. Do you think that the nostalgia plays a key role in this book being so beloved, in particular, maybe because of the movie and the way the movie brought the characters to life in the 60s, and because partly so many people read it in school? Or do you think that there's something else going on, sort of in the life of the work in our culture?
Right. Well, there's the movie, and then there's the book, and then there's the movie. Mm-hmm. And both are beloved. And one of the reasons I think that, I mean, one of the most basic reason that people love the book is because it's a great book. It's a story well told, and it's got vivid characters, and it's, it moves along quickly, and it's a coming of age story. But another reason people love it is because they read it early. It's usually one of the first quote unquote serious books that they read, because oftentimes they're assigned it in eighth grade or ninth grade. Mm-hmm. And so certainly there's an element of nostalgia to it in people's own lives, and that this is one of the first kind of serious classic works that they're assigned, and people, and so I think that has a lot to do with, its success in these polls that are taken, that kind of thing. Now, you mentioned Atticus Finch being named the greatest hero. That's right. That was in a poll of movie heroes. He was named the number one hero ever, on the Hollywood big screen. Mm. And that has to do just with the popularity of the movie. And it's, again, it's a lovely movie. It's Gregory Peck, one of the most beloved stars of his generation and of many generations. And in his only Oscar-turning, Oscar-winning role as Atticus Finch. And so, all of that has to do with the popularity of, and the ongoing popularity. But I think it really is about this issue of the book being continually assigned year after year, that just makes it this kind of phenomenon within American literary culture. Hmm.
Do you think it deserves, obviously you like the book and you like the character, but do you think it deserves to be considered, up there for that sort of award of the great American novel, as some people claim? It's up there with Hawthorne or Fitzgerald or Mark Twain or any number of other books that are sort of are in the running for that award, such as the award is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I like the book. I mean, the book is clearly has plenty of flaws and, it's dated in many respects. And, you know, I didn't come to write this book because I thought it was the great American novel or because I think that it's a book that every American should read. I wrote the book because I think it's a fascinating question mm-hmm. as to who Atticus Finch is and, mm-hmm. and who Harper Lee intended him to be and how that character has changed over time. That's what interested me about this project is just the fact that, you know, you have this beloved figure who serves as a kind of touchstone of morality and decency, kind of an American popular culture. And then you have this other text that's discovered and the character is very, very different. And, yeah. and how do you explain that? Yeah. And that's the question that provoked me and set me off to use my skills as a researcher and a historian to try to answer that question.
Do you think that the evolving character of Atticus Finch will damper any enthusiasm for the original book over the years, you know, as we look 25, 30 years down the road and children, you know, my kids are 6 and 7 right now as they begin to read it and they'll have this other text to sort of color the way they view the original text. Whereas we didn't have that. And, you know, previous generations didn't have that. So in 25 years, do you think that we'll feel the same way about that book? Do you think that it'll be a book that will be considered part of the, you know, one of the greats of the American canon and future generations kind of the way it is now?
I don't know what will happen in 25 years, but in the 3 years since Watchmen has come out, it has not seemed to dampen at all the enthusiasm and the love of To Kill a Mockingbird and the Atticus Finch of To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, just look at the success and the attention that's been given to, you know, the play that just appeared on, yeah. on Broadway. Yeah. And so I don't know, but I actually hope that Watchmen is read and studied and considered because I think Watchmen makes Mockingbird all the more interesting, mm-hmm. makes it much more interesting and much more important. Well, because you see the degree to which Harper Lee was struggling to shape that character, and you see a lot more clearly the way that she was engaged politically with her own times. Mm. You know, the politics of To Kill a Mockingbird are muted. The book is set in the South, but 20 years early in the 1930s, not in the time in the late 1950s when she was writing. But you see in Ghosts of a Watchman, the degree to which Harper Lee was politically minded and writing and wanting to use her fiction to kind of say something about the political crisis that the South was in. Mm-hmm. And so it gives us a lot more information and a lot more to go on in thinking about what she was trying to do when she first sat down to write a serious, sustained piece of fiction.
Mm. Do you think that it has the same sort of literary merit, you know, kind of, I guess,
No. I mean, it's a first novel. It's a first yeah. attempt at novel. It's an yeah, unedited true. Novel. There was yeah. no professional editor who had worked with her on that. I mean, it's like a lot. It's a work that it's an apprentice work that like most novelists, you know, you write a novel and it's not what you want it to be. And you put it in a drawer somewhere and it sits there, or some novelists burn them, you know, and they don't want anybody to see them.
Yeah, so she didn't even know it existed.
Right, right. Yeah. And so it's definitely not the work that Mockingbird is. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some elements, there's some passages that she took straight from Watchmen that she used in Mockingbird, you know, the description of Makeham and Makeham's history yeah. and that sort of thing. Yeah. So, you know, clearly it's an apprentice work. But what's important that I discovered in my research for this book that I wrote is that it's not, as it has often been reported, as a first draft of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's a separate work. You can see this in the from documents in the archives of Harper Collins, Harper Lee's longtime publisher, that she always imagined it as a separate work, and that mm-hmm. and that she talked. There's letters when she talks about conversations with her literary agent Maurice Crane, who encouraging her to put Watchmen aside, to work on this earlier novel when she's writing about the life of the characters, and maybe somehow she can join them together, or that there might be some kind of a series of, you know, be part of a larger kind of narrative arc, this novel and the other novel, and maybe connected by a third novel. You know, that's the kind of discussions they were having. It. So she always imagined these characters as the same characters that she was writing about in both. And that's important to remember. It's not like she wrote first in Ghost at a Watchman a version of Atticus Finch as a kind of racist reactionary and then threw that out and said, no, I'm going to make him this idealistic figure. No, she saw this as the same character she was seeing at different times in this character's life under very different circumstances and from very different point of view. Because, of course, in Mockingbird, we see Atticus, you know, through the eyes of the adolescent scout. And so we see him as, you know, children oftentimes at that age see their parents as this kind of heroic figure.
Do you think that the version of Atticus in To Kill a Mockingbird is, well, you use the word idealistic. Do you think he's too idealistic? Do you think that there is something sort of unrealistic about him? And I know that to some extent she was trying to at least somewhat basing the character on her father. But do you think that his sort of idealism rings true and is consistent with the world she's trying to create? Or is, well, I'll just leave it there for now.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a complicated answer. I mean, she did base the character on her father. She based both versions of Atticus were based on her father. One of the things I did in my research is I actually found out a lot more about her father than we've ever really known up to this point. Her father, like Atticus Finch, was a small town lawyer and state legislator. But unlike Atticus Finch, he also was the partial owner and full-time sole editor of the local newspaper, the Monroe Journal. And he edited that paper for 18 years. And I went back and read all 18 years worth of the paper. And he had this editorial page where he was writing 2-3 editorials a week on all kinds of topics under the sun. So I was able to kind of recreate his political worldview.
Was he doing that?
Well, he had this kind of labored 19th century prose, you know, but he was a very astute, observer of the world. He was opinionated. He had strong ideas. He had only an eighth grade education. That was the highest grade he ever completed. But he was a kind of self-educated. He's kind of Lincoln-esque in his reading habits and habits of self-education.
And you do see that in the book with Atticus.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And they were huge readers. They loved books. They loved history, English history, Southern history. And so you can see how from those editorials, how, A.C. Lee, the name of her father, Amasa Coleman Lee, people call him A.C. But A.C. Lee, you know, wrote editorials denouncing lynching and mob violence in the 1930s. You know, he wrote editorials in the 1930s denouncing demagoguery. He couldn't stand Huey Long. He denounced him as a demagogue who was dangerous figure. So you see these kind of principled stance he would take in his editorial page that could clearly inspire the kind of idealism of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. What you also see, particularly by the late 1930s and particularly by the war years, World War II, which was setting loose all kinds of forces, reform impulses, social and political movements in Southern political life, that you see how he begins to defend in very traditional ways, you know, state rights and the Southern segregationist position, such that you could see that in Ghosts at a Watchman, those passages when Atticus is defending kind of the South to his adult daughter, Jean Louise, you know, those things come directly from some of his editorials, you know, could have come directly from some of his editorials in the, 1944, 45, 46, in those years.
Do you, when I first read Ghost at a Watchman, I remember being sort of torn because it felt like an unedited book. And so I wondered if it would have been more, it would have been better served to have been sort of released through more academic means as opposed to as through, you know, as this newly published book from a major publisher, right, that's, you know, it's meant to sort of operate in the same realm as so many, as To Kill a Mockingbird, it might have been better served as a sort of as something for academics to study and then share through that means and through their own analysis of it. Do you think that it would have been better served that way, or do you think it was appropriately released as sort of a major book through a major publisher, given that it hadn't been edited and so forth?
Yeah, I guess it depends on who, in terms of whether it would have been better served, it depends on who you're serving.
Yeah, true.
You know, I mean, I think it was better served for the publisher to have it released as a novel.
You know,
and I do think the publisher had certain restrictions placed on them as to what Harper Lee's own, how she wanted it to be released. You know, it wasn't just their call. It was the author's call.
Sure.
So, you know, those are questions that I don't have good answers to as to how it should have been released. But my feeling about the novel is, whatever you think about it as a work of fiction, and there are a lot of people who see it like you do, that it's not a very polished work of fiction. Mm-hmm. It is fascinating as a historical document.
Absolutely. Yeah.
As this document that gives us insight into what she was trying to do. And so that's how I approached it. And I think it's fascinating on those terms.
So Harper Lee, she was something of I don't want to say recluse. I don't think she was, my understanding is she wasn't quite like, you know, J.D. Salinger, for example.
No, she wasn't.
She kept to herself and kind of seemed to avoid the limelight. She didn't prefer the fame that came with publishing such a significant book, but she didn't, she certainly didn't publish anything else. So what do you think that her legacy is as a writer in American culture, having produced just the one book and then sort of slipping away into some semblance of privacy anyway? I mean, how do you think she should be remembered?
Well, as the author of one of the most beloved books in American literature.
Do you think that, she belongs, well, I guess this is kind of an unfair question, but do you think she belongs in the American canon with the Hawthorns and Fitzgeralds and Twains and James Fenimore Cooper and those other writers?
I don't know. I'm not a literary expert. I'm a historian.
Sure.
And I don't have much to say or really all that great of interest in trying to figure out her place in the canon or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I'll leave it to the literature professors to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, fair enough. It's always so fascinating to me. A character like her, and in some ways, you know, I think she is a very interesting character herself, much like the characters that she creates. And you know, from her friendship with Truman Capote to the way that she's kind of slipped out of the public eye, she is one of those people that seems like she would have been great to get to know. Did you ever get a chance to meet her or any of her family?
No, I did not meet Harper Lee. I did not meet her. I've met her her niece and two of her nephews. I've spoken with one nephew on the phone, and I've met the other nephew, and actually have spoken with him often. He came and visited one of my classes here at Emory, and he is an incredibly knowledgeable and great source of insight about his aunt's fiction. He himself is a former college professor and retired college professor, has a PhD in literature from Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. Ed Connor is his name, and Ed was enormously helpful and also her niece Molly Lee, who lives in Alabama. Both of them had lots of memories of not only their aunt, which I was interested in, but also their grandfather, who I was really interested in this book, you know, Harper Lee's father, in trying to get to understand him as a person. So they were really helpful for me in the research that I was doing. Hmm.
Do you think that she, was it purely an aversion to the fame, do you think, that caused her to sort of slip out of the public eye, or do you think she was feeling a sort of pressure to produce something that could possibly live up to Kill a Mockingbird, and so she just felt like she couldn't possibly do that, so she didn't, I don't know what to say, she didn't make an attempt, because I don't know that, but so she didn't pursue that to the point where she published anything at any rate.
Well, the real answer is I don't know, but another answer is, you know, she herself talked about in a kind of, you know, offhand way about the pressures of trying to write another great American classic. You know, that, you know, she talked about how she wrote a really great book, and you know, it's hard to write those, and she was content to let it stand by itself. You know, if you're not going to write something this good, why put something else out there? And you know, she was quoted as saying something along those lines, you know, when answering this question about why not another novel. So, I think it's fair to assume that was part of it. She held herself to a very high standard and didn't want to put out anything that was not up to that standard.
I assume there's no evidence or suggestion that there are any other works stored away in any other lockboxes or anything, is there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there may well be. I think there are materials that Harper Lee's estate has that people have not seen. I don't know what the extent of them is. I couldn't really get a sense of that from any research that I'd done. But there may be. We don't really know. Hmm.
Well, here's my final question for you. I told you 30 minutes and we're coming up on that. So here's my final question. Flannery O'Connor sort of famously wrote to somebody, I believe in a letter, somewhat snarkily saying, I wonder if all these people who are buying up this book realize they're buying a children's book. And you mentioned, you know, for a lot of people, it is sort of a first, quote, serious book. And it's one of the, you know, it's commonly assigned in ninth grade. And then kind of we spend months or weeks or whatever writing analytical essays about it. But so it's, for many people, it's one of the first books that people really begin to study pretty closely. Do you think that O'Connor's contention that it is basically a children's book is fair, and that her snark was justified? I mean, maybe that's probably not a fair way to ask the question, because I suppose her snark was not justified given what we know now. But do you think that it should be best remembered as a book for children, or do you think that it deserves something sort of more serious, a more serious approach than that?
Well, I think Harper Lee herself was quoted in a book that was written about her that she was glad that the category of young adult literature didn't exist at the time when the book came out, because she thought that it might have gotten characterized that way, and thereby not have kind of won the broader audience that it did. And, you know, I think there is a kind of YA element to the book, in the sense that the main protagonists are the children, and the main drama in the novel, in the story, is that the children's coming of age. Mm-hmm. And they're coming to realize that this beloved town that they have is full of all these mysteries and all of these injustices that they had no idea about, and coming to grips with that and wrestling with that is the main drama of the story. And that's a story, that's a kind of classic narrative of young adult literature. But my feeling is that there's some, you know, even if it were categorized as young adult literature, there's some really wonderful works of young adult literature.
Sure.
And wonderful absolutely. Works that endure and that are important and that are vital. I mean, Separate Peace may well have been a young adult literature if it came out today. Hmm. You know, you can imagine lots of different books that would be categorized differently if they had appeared today. But I think still are, you know, a really accomplished, beautiful pieces of literature that have been and will continue to be read by young people and adults for many years to come. Mm.
Well, thank you so much for taking a few minutes with me. I've enjoyed this conversation, and I hope people will check out your book on Atticus Finch. That was published in 2017, is that right?
My book was published in May of 2018.
Okay, 2018. Oh, so it's recent.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you have to do the book tour and all that?
Yeah. We did some nice events in throughout the summer and in the fall. And yeah, it's been a really fun book to talk about because it's been, it's a, because, you know, Mockingbird is so, so loved, that, it's, you can engage a really broad and interested audience with this kind of work. So that's been very gratifying.
Have you found that people tend to actually end up really what they're interested in as much as anything is just Atticus Finch more, say, than Harper Lee or the backstory behind the novel? I mean, it seems like he has his own sort of place within our culture, you know, all to himself.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing how, you know, people will talk about Atticus Finch like he's a real person and, yeah, you know, and some people don't quite, it doesn't register them with them that he isn't a real person. You know, they have such an identification, well, not just with Atticus, but with all the characters in the novel, yeah, but particularly yeah, with Atticus. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much to Dr. Joseph Crispino for chatting with me. And thanks to Adam Andrews for joining me as well. And of course, thanks to all of you who've been listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you did, please make sure you subscribe to this podcast, leave a rating, leave a review, help us spread the word. I'd be really grateful for that. And of course, don't forget about our other podcasts here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. You can find The Daily Poem by searching Daily Poem. You can find Close Reads, where we talk about novels, by searching Close Reads. And you can find The Plays The Thing, which is a podcast that focuses on all the plays of Shakespeare one act at a time, by searching The Plays The Thing wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, you can also go to closereadspods.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with another episode of Libromania.